Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 20th, 2006. Today's session is a forum entitled Anti-Racism for Everyone, moderated by Paul Olson, number FO2006-08. Let's listen.
Coordinator, and tonight's forum is on anti-racism. And our rules simply are we will stop at 9:45. Maybe we'll go to 9:50 this time since we're starting a little late. But to keep it to an hour, and the purpose of that is to encourage conversation beyond these walls and hopefully spread that out through other people that you encounter throughout the week. It's your show, so it's centers, the whole forum idea centers around, maybe a better word is a town meeting, centered around your discussion and with leadership from Vervon and Peter. I'll introduce it by saying, and let these guys introduce themselves. I had finished a master's degree in American literature before I had ever heard of Richard Wright. And I would suggest to you that that is institutional racism. At three different institutions that said, these are the people you need to read to have a master's degree in American literature. And Richard Wright wasn't the old story, it was the dead white men, you know. So that's my sense of coming to this and introducing this whole concept of how do we look at racism and what is it and how we define it and how you want to express your concerns with it. And with that, these men are on to introduce themselves and say what they will. If this is hard, I can call on you.
Where you want me to go first?
Yeah.
Okay.
Figure out what I
mean. Okay. My name is Verlon Brown, and I'm a Lutheran pastor in Seattle. I used to be village pastor here. I was village pastor here for 3 years. And I went through Missouri Synod, went to St. John's in Kansas, and then I went to Concordia Senior College, which was a Missouri Synod prep school, which is where Peter and I met. This was back in the mid-70s. Yeah, 73 or 4, or somewhere along in there. And then I went to Seminex and graduated from Seminex. I did 1 year at Luther in Minneapolis, or St. Paul, a disastrous year, I might add, and for reasons that we're here today. And then I went out into the world to try to make my way in the ministry, and I guess my big piece about racism or anti-racism or white privilege or whatever is that I believe I believe this guy named Noel Ignatow, who writes about abolitionism, and I firmly believe that whiteness, not white people, but whiteness, should be abolished. And if you're not working to abolish that, then you're wasting precious time. And to me, it's the difference. I compare it to the difference between being a Christian and accepting life as God as your Christ as your personal Savior, and that's it. And you never do anything with it. And Christ is always asking us to move beyond that, to act, to put our bodies on the line for the faith. And I feel the same way about racism in America. It does no good for a white person to have me as a friend, or a spouse, a lover, or however that is, unless that person is willing to put their bodies on the line and make some sacrifices for the greater good, which is to abolish whiteness, which is to somehow take all those privileges that whites have gained over the past 400 years at the expense of people of color, African Americans, Native Americans to be exact, and spread that wealth and make sure that that gets passed on to people who are not white. So that's my spiel.
I'd like to reiterate that it does no good to have Verlaine as a friend. And obviously I can only say that because he's been such a good friend and such a patient friend for just 33 years. You're getting old.
But who's counting?
Yeah, who's counting? My name is Peter Nash. As you heard, I studied at Concordia College in Fort Wayne, Indiana, before that Concordia College, which was a junior college in those days, in Ann Arbor. Brian and I met up in 73, fall of 73, for our last 2 years of college. And that was the period when the Missouri Synod, Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, was imploding upon itself in its infinite wisdom about plenty of verbal plenary, what is it? Literal inspiration of the entire scriptures. And, Verlaine, where he went, I went out east to a neutral field, in a Presbyterian seminary, and then came back to the Midwest and did graduate work, and then I finally had to start working, and taught seminary for 11 years, and then taught seminary for 11 years in Brazil, and then came back 3 years ago, almost exactly 3 years ago, and began teaching at Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa. And so I've spent, you know, well, Verlaine had to go out and earn a living. I stayed in school and have seen a lot of the same things he has seen, manifestations of a lot of the same things that he described. But it is a different, it's a different world that we live in the academy. And where Paul started by talking about institutional racism and how do you get a master's degree or a PhD in this country in U.S. literature and not know about James Baldwin and Richard Wright? But it's still happening today. And my research focus for the last 6 to 8 years has been how we manage to do that in the church when we read scripture. We read about these Afro-Asiatic people as if they were somehow Proto-Europeans. And we don't even seem to want to change that. So that's research focus. I came in here early so I could dominate the conversation, put this in front of you on the board. Most people, you know, we grew up in the affirmative action days, and then when people were pretending to try to take affirmative action, in terms of education, it was easier for all of us, white, black, and indifferent, as my mother would say, to get an education than it is today. But before that, before we got to college, from the end of World War II to 1964, according to California Newsreel and a three-part series that they put on, that PBS bought up and used in 2003, with the Federal Housing Administration, $120 billion was set aside, federal funds, your tax dollars and mine and my dad's, just to make that clear, in U.S. loan guarantees and building subsidies for the creation of the suburban middle class. And they redefined whiteness in this process after World War II. We talked about this in a couple of different sessions, that Italians, Slavs, a lot of Mediterranean-type folks were not considered white folk until this period, or even at the beginning of this period. I have on my desk for purposes of one of the classes I teach, an exclusive covenant, a restrictive covenant, about one of the subdivisions in Waverly, Iowa, where all kinds of black people and Mediterraneans, you might imagine, were trying to move in 1948, just like today. And the really sweet thing about having this for my class is because the lawyer who witnessed this is, I think, the grandfather of our current president of Board of Trustees. The people who were selling the land was the institution that was selling the land was the Lutheran Children's Home. And it looks really creepy to see the Lutherans and the forebearers of our current Board of Regents signing on there, but then to realize that this is U.S. government policy. these restrictive covenants were U.S. government policy. They were declared unconstitutional in 1972. Even Grandquist, who died last year, had this was one of the stumbling blocks of his being approved as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, that he had owned a home, I think, in Arizona that had a restrictive covenant. And he just brushed it off and said, well, that's unconstitutional. I knew that. Everybody knew that. So it wasn't a problem. Well, 98% of that money was set aside for exclusively white, a majority, with the remaining 2% available to people of color went primarily into rental units. So in the United States, where it seems to be so often all about the Benjamins, you know, the $100 bills, when we talk about anti-racism, I'm all about, you know, giving some of this money back. Try to figure out what 10% of this is and what would happen if 10% of this $120 billion somehow got infused into African-American communities, Latino communities today. Yes, sir.
I'm not questioning the number, or the breakdown, but the way that's not $120 billion set aside. That's $120 billion in loan guarantees.
Loan guarantees and subsidies, that's what it says in the board?
Yeah, no. So the way it worked is the federal government guaranteed the mortgage, mm-hmm. right? So, but that doesn't mean that they put the money up for the mortgage.
There's $120 billion in wealth that was guaranteed by the government that was restricted for white folks only.
I'm not disputing that, but you said they set aside $120 billion, and that's not how they did it. Right? They assumed a $120 billion liability for white folks only, of which they probably had to spend, $120 million.
And that makes it different how?
It just makes it different to understand what that number means.
That the government was willing to risk $120 billion for one group and exclude another group. That's still the same thing.
Right.
Whether they spent the money or not, they guaranteed the loans exclusively, 98% exclusively for white folks.
I'm not disputing that. That's what they did, guaranteed the loans,
It wasn't just loan guarantees, there were also subsidies for building subsidies.
I understand.
So what the breakdown is there, I don't have, but. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir, sorry.
I'd like to add another piece to that figure, which I think is, in my humble opinion, is more destructive than the fact that the government was guaranteeing, those loans. And put forth those subsidies. They built the interstate highway system, which in almost every metropolitan area in the country served the purpose of moving people in these subsidized suburbs quickly out of the inner city to the suburbs and back for work every day, zooming past all the poor neighborhoods.
Zooming through.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly.
Yeah.
Bulldozing block after block after block after block of poorer neighborhoods, almost always, poor and or non-white, that were completely abandoned by urban planners and systematically impoverished if not bulldozed by the interstate highway system. I just started learning about the process of the building freeways in college, and it's absolutely heartbreaking how many vital neighborhoods were bulldozed for the sake of getting people quickly to the suburbs. And of course, billions were spent on that. The largest public works program ever in the world. Although maybe that's being replaced by the dam in China.
Has anybody here experienced or witnessed in your community or anywhere in your life at any time these kinds of discriminatory acts? Anybody else? He points to one.
I had friends, I don't know how many years ago it was now, maybe 10, not that long ago, who bought a house, and when they got the deed, found the restrictive covenants were still there. And when they brought it up to the realtor, they got the same response, oh, but nobody knows they're unenforceable, so don't worry about it. And that still seems to be, I mean, as far as I know, no one's ever gone in and said, you need to remove these now. And so they still sit there on those deeds.
Yeah, the deeds and then the title searches. And then, you know, it was only, I think, 2002 before the last anti-miscegenation law in the country went off the books. You know, it was still on the books that it was illegal. I think it was in Alabama for a black person and a white person to marry. Lawyers would say, "Oh, it costs too much money to go back and change all this. I don't know what it costs. I don't know. I don't really understand title searches and what their real function is, and to keep that in the record." For me, it turned out to be a useful thing, so my students can see that the wealth even of our college is somewhat in the health of our neighborhood, because this was the U.S. redlining that we all know about learned about mostly in the 1970s was U.S. government policy to create stable neighborhoods. So that our students can see that their wealth, their well-being, their ability to go to school for as cheaply as $29,000 a year today comes in part based on these restrictive covenants.
You don't want them to take those out of the title deed, so. I mean, because that's the record.
Yeah, I
have a house in Maryland that had a restricted covenant in it. And so it comes up the title transfers, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, the title in Maryland would, if you really got into it, would go all the way back to the grant to Lord Baltimore in 1637. That's where you trace back the title. And it is evidence, right? It's the history.
Yeah.
It's there. You know, it's not history you want to wipe out.
No, but these people, but my friends, if you just looked at the deed, you would assume these people are buying this property subject to those covenants because they're still there. Well, you can get a ruling that those covenants are unenforceable and they don't follow the deed anymore. But people say, I have too much money and nobody pays attention anyway, so they still sit there on the deed. But you don't have to continue to transfer that deed with those covenants on there. There's a way to get them off.
I've never seen one. What did they say?
This one said no Jews in particular. That was the first one, was Jews. And then blacks wrote down the list.
Yeah.
It says no XXX max.
Yeah,
yes.
Says this property cannot be sold to.
Cannot be sold to?
Yeah, and then
the covenant. I didn't know that existed.
And the covenant that I have a copy of in this tract of, this tract, the big subdivision is the tract, right? Okay. This, you know, set of lots that it specifies that no Negro shall spend more than, except for servants shall overnight in that area.
And that's in Waverly?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's Waverly, Iowa,
Waverly,
folks,
Iowa.
The heart of the Midwest.
And it's still there? It's still alive.
Well, it's part of the, what is the technical term? When you do the title search to see who owned and what were the conditions
of
sale. So from 1946, let's say 1948, when this subdivision was built, until 1972-ish, when it was finally declared unconstitutional. No, 1964 with the Fair Housing Act. So every sale after that, there's no way to enforce that covenant, except for social pressure.
But can it still be put on it?
It's part of the history of the
property.
The title search gives you the history of the property, the ownership, and the conditions under which it was sold.
So it's not new, it's the same one.
It's the same one, yeah.
Yeah, if you want to sell your property and reserve the mineral rights, then you could say, I'll sell you my property, but I reserve the right to the minerals under your land. And it would become a covenant in your title that because you never sold that right to somebody, they could never sell it to somebody else. Or you could say, My covenant on a house I had, you can't build fences higher than 4 feet, which was one of the covenants along with you can't sell to Negroes, was what the language was. And so I did not possess that right to sell it on to somebody else until they were extinguished by the law.
So, Paul said that's Waverly, Iowa, the heart of the Midwest. Most of the sundown laws in the United States were in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. The laws that said no Negroes, no Mediterraneans, no Jews in this town, so they couldn't acquire the right to stay by having stayed before. Most of those cities were in the Midwest, but there are famous cities, Darien, Connecticut. This is our legacy. The wealth, the stability, and it was the, again, the U.S. government's presumption that stable communities were homogeneous.
Homogeneous.
One of them.
They both work.
We're white ghettos.
Yeah. Have we talked about practices in the private sector yet? These are government policies we've been talking about. There's also there's a standard practice in realty called blockbusting, where realty companies would make money off of people's racial fears by going around the neighborhood in early inner ring suburbs or in within city limits of big cities, saying, a black family just bought a house down the street. You better sell your house before the value goes down in this neighborhood. And suddenly, everyone on the block all the white folk on the block would sell their houses and move out to the suburbs, and thus making the realty company a bunch of money.
And the realty company would then sell those houses to black families at exorbitant prices.
Exactly.
But that was also in response to published government policy. Mm-hmm. And that was a relatively short period. I think almost every city outlawed that rather quickly once they figured out what was going on. Mm-hmm. When I lived in Chicago from 1978 to about 1973, it was, for most of that time, it was illegal to put up a for sale sign in the city of Chicago because of what that was one of the ways that blockbusting worked. Mm-hmm. So sometime in the 70s. 60s, they passed a law to stop that kind of rampant scare tactic realty.
Mm-hmm. Need to call it. Let's see.
Yeah. Veron, as you've talked this week, and you've described whiteness as a history of privilege, mm-hmm. developing privilege, mm-hmm. and have defined two problems. One is the system that maintains that, mm-hmm. and two is just the inequality itself. And so what I've heard you say is the solution to that at this point, or one solution in your mind, seems to be to try to, one is to try to undermine or derail the system of whiteness as a whole, mm-hmm. and then two is to try to bring people of color, black specifically, into the benefit stream. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that? I've not heard you say what you would like to see happen, or where we think society ought to be moving towards at this point.
Well, I gave a whole list of things. Some were from this Noel Ignatoff, yeah. and some were from Michael Moore, and I forget where I got some of the others from. But there were specific things, like Michael Moore said. He had just decided not to hire another white person for a while.
Right.
Just to not hire a white person. That there were plenty of people of color who could do any of the positions that he had available. And he said that if 100 people, 1,000 people, however many people in a city would do that, what a difference. Mm-hmm. It would make, there are tons of jobs out there that black people, native people, people of color in general, just never even hear about, never see, relatives, the biggest I can't think of the word. What is it called when I hate getting old.
It's better than the alternative.
Yeah. What's it called when you, civil rights, when you get benefits?
Reparation?
Entitlement?
About reparation?
I can't think of it. But, you know, he said that in terms of, everybody's against quotas. Yeah, thank you. Everybody's against quotas, but, you know, he says the biggest quota system going on is nepotism. Yeah. Whites handing these positions down to their sons and their daughters and their, you know. I've been coming to Holden now since the mid-70s, and I'm amazed at how many professors' children are now professors, you know. It's, you know, how does that happen? You know, well, of course it happens because their parents can, you know, open doors for them. And so Michael Moore said, you know, one way you can stop that is just to say, let's not, as a company or in my business, these next four positions, I'm just going to hire black people. Mm-hmm. Or something to that, you know, real positions, not in terms of this position is, you know, typically janitorial, that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's open to people of color. But I mean, just in general, and one example that I said that at Holden, I've participated in many discussions about how can we get more people of color up here. And I said, you know, have people of color in positions of power. You know, I was the very first and only African-American pastor who ever spent any time up here. And then when I was here, there was one African-American woman who was a program staff, you know. And so, you know, you attract, if you want to pass this on and not just pass it on to whites, you know, you have to make some decisions like that. And that's one thing, you know, you can do. And you know, there's a list of other things that you could do. But if you just did that, you know, think what a difference that would make.
He's the really practical one. He works with people on the street and sees what's going on. I have the privilege of not even working most summers. I'm just thinking a lot, but in my field, again, go back to what Paul said starting off, just start telling the truth about what's out there. You know, let's start in the church telling the truth about the biblical world. I think it'd be a lot more difficult to deal with Arabs and Africans as somehow subhuman if we realize that Semites and Africans are the biblical characters. And that's where my research has taken me for the last nearly a decade now. I think we never really gave affirmative action a chance. I think we did some silly things when we instituted affirmative action. And I was troubled about the time I was leaving Brazil to see that they were ready to make some of the same silly mistakes. I don't think you give my kids, who are relatively well off, the affirmative action slots. You know, it's not about filling up the seats with brown people. I mean, that does make some difference. But I think we need to do something about poor whites and poor black kids, people who are just out of the cycle right now, to make sure that they get decent education, get decent health benefits. So my overhaul would be have more to do with social class than strictly with color, but that would take care of a huge part of the color disequality in this country. And I get to be a really scary person because I don't care. My brother's a dentist. He's frightened of me because I'm all about socialized medicine. I think we need to make sure that nobody, but the richest country in the history of humankind, and we let people go without dental care, we let people go without health care, we let people go without a chance to get educated in a decent way. And we're fine with it because my kids' schools are okay. So both of you work in context where, you know, I'm kind of, do you have a sense that as much as I might want to abolish whiteness, as you work with folks, are folks teachable?
You mean folks?
Well, I mean at work or in the churches you connect with. I mean, we're just getting ready to bring on a Native American pastor in my congregation. And it's the hidden racism, I mean, it's just
thick. Yeah. Where is your congregation? Because that makes a lot of difference.
Portland, Oregon. Yeah.
What it means to bring on a Native American pastor varies from Wyoming to Wisconsin to Michigan. Yeah. So.
No, I don't think people are teachable. I think Peter and I telling white people it's not very effective. I mean, it's kind of a slot. It's almost a stereotype now. Black people coming in doing anti-racism workshops, that kind of stuff. It's really work that should be done by white people. But white people aren't doing a very good job. You know, they're not talking about abolishing whiteness. You know, they turn it into some little interpersonal games that you play and liking people of color and inviting them over for dinner. And, you know, that's just, as far as I'm concerned, that's nothing. You know, it needs to be attacked on a systematic level, you know. And I think the only ones who can do that when they decide to do it are white people, because you know where the bodies are buried, you know. And until you pick up the mantle and decide to do it, Peter and I can raise the issue, we can raise the question, but you know, until you decide to do it, it's not going to happen.
Yes, it's me that needs to say, my name is Susan, and I'm a racist. I mean, I need to do my own work. We need to do our own work. There's a new ELCA class, actually. Study on. And for us white folks to look at ourselves and do our own work, and what's the name of it? Is
Troubling the Waters.
I don't know if anybody's seen it, but it's the very first thing out that in our church. It's really a good start. It's really our congregation has done it once. We need to do it again, and it's an opportunity to look at what it means to be white and what it means to get the 120 billion and what that means in the history of the church and what that means in, you know, in every single part of our lives, and to really take a good look at that and to start doing our own work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can't do it. You can't do it for me, Verlana.
I think part of white racism goes, you know, a big part goes way beyond one's individual racism. Racism is about power.
That's right.
And the people with power are the ones who can give up whiteness. And I'll be concrete. If I teach literature, and there's a canon, and if we have a semester long and we can fit 10 books in there and we rattle off what those 10 books are, something's got to go. I mean, that is the whiteness of that American literature canon. That's why this kid way back with a master's degree didn't know Richard Wright. Somebody's, you know, am I going to take out, name it, William Faulkner Goes because Richard Wright comes in? Oh my gosh, I can't do that. That's, I'm trying to find, and maybe you can do that, explore that too. In your profession, in your work, where can you surrender? I mean, there's only 100% of time in that, I don't need to go that way. Just look at that example. Am I going to take Faulkner out? Am I going to take Hemingway out? Am I going to take Robert Frost out?
Fitzgerald.
And put in, huh?
Fitzgerald.
Yeah, he's already gone for me. But something has to give, just in that, in my own tradition, that canon will not give. This is who you have to know to be an educated person in American literature. Well, that's power, and the people who sit with that power are the ones that have to give it up, I think. And so individual bigotry, you know, okay, we fight that. But that's a different kind of problem than the institutional structures that have to surrender part of that whiteness, I think.
I think more important than saying I am X and I am a racist is saying I am X and I am the beneficiary of racist policies that enrich my life every day and impoverish people here and around the world.
I think what you just said,
Ramon,
just really struck me because, like you said, it doesn't matter unless white people are doing something to stop this. It's really not going to make a difference. I consider myself right now, like I feel like I've been really naive for the longest time because I sit here and I think because my son is of mixed race and identifies as a black little boy, you know, he considers himself black, and because I am around black people a lot and I just forget, I guess, like when we go into a restaurant or we go into the store and I'm the only white person sometimes, I forget, like to me, I don't see the racism, I guess, because I guess it's not aimed towards me. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. So I feel like I want to sit here and say, oh, well, in Seattle where I live, it's not a big problem. And I'm never getting any problems when I go anywhere with my son or with my boyfriend or something like that. But there still is racism out there, and it may not be a direct type of racism, it might be an indirect. And there's things I guess I need to do. I'm not sure what I can do. I'm open to doing whatever, but there's things that I need to do to combat that and help against that.
Well, I think you've done quite a bit. Individually, you know, in terms of, I mean, you've put yourself in a position where you're not in charge. You know, you put yourself in a position where you're a minority, you know. And I think if every white person in this room did that, that would be a help, you know, to go someplace where you're not in charge, to go someplace where you know, your money or your status or your class doesn't get you anything. You know, if you could do that, it would help. It would maybe help you understand how to figure out how to connect with this system and spread the wealth, and you wouldn't see brown people and black people as inferior beings, you know.
You know, I was just thinking about that. One of the things we haven't said is that African Americans, Latinos, have repeatedly proved in this country that we are every bit as capable in any field that you put us in. Eventually, when the barriers are removed, whether it's sports or business, music, education, we excel. You know, some of us excel, probably a slightly smaller percentage of us than you, because the deck is still pretty stacked in the educational system. And still we have these myths of brown inferiority in this country. We talk blithely every day in the educational system in Iowa about the achievement gap and what we can do to close the achievement gap. Code for white kids doing better than black kids in Iowa schools. The simple answer for me is give us the same chances. And ironically, as pissed off as many of us are at the Republican Party, where it tends to happen first in government is in the Republican Party. You know, doesn't that really piss you off?
Yeah. What happens first?
Where African Americans get a chance and Latinos get a chance. Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, I love her.
Oh.
Yeah. Mr. Redefined Torture, Roberto Gonzalez. Okay. Democrats can't see their way clear to
Secretary of Commerce, 3 years. He came from Battle Creek?
Don't forget Clarence Thomas. I'd like to.
That's our favorite Hispanic
African American. I mean, we've been talking for 45 minutes. Is there anything you can tell us that you think can be, that you can do, that's worth trying to do, that does this?
I was going to ask the question about categories, and you know that on the census, we categorize people. And is it all that healthy for us to know how many African Americans there are and how many Hispanics and we used to have to decide for our mixed race children which category we're going to put them in, and now we can check mixed race if we want to.
Well, I just think there are.
Is there going to come a time when we won't even?
No.
We're all
no.
human beings.
No, that's not going to happen.
It's not
unless you all decide to make it happen. There are tons of smoke screens. There are tons of things that society does to keep you as overseers, period. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the name of the game. Keep you scared that your money's gonna go away, someone's gonna come in, take your daughters, blah, 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 blah. It's all smoke screens, you know. And every time they pop up, you know, it's like a wedge issue. You know, they pop up. And people get all worked up about it, and then this is going on over here. You know, that whole overseer thing continues to exist. So that's my question for you all, is tell me what you can do to move beyond the overseer role.
Something very small and very practical. And I am a writer, so language is really important to me. And one of the things that, this is so small, and it sounds counterintuitive maybe, but to start using the phrase white person when you're describing people, that's something that it really has made a difference for me. Because one of the things about whiteness, one of the really nasty things about whiteness is that it's like you're saying, a smokescreen. It covers itself up. So not only is whiteness out there as in all these privileges, all these ways of going directly to power, but it also has this blanket over itself so that we just think of it as normal humanity. You know, so the universal person for most white people in the country is a white person. You know, and so when you're describing people in a mostly white context, you would never say, well, I met this white guy, Harry, you know, when you're describing him to somebody else. And so Harry suddenly doesn't have race. But anybody who's a person of color has race. It becomes the problem of somebody of color. All the conflicts we have about the idea of race become the problems of people of color. Because white people aren't raced. White people are just people. So one of the things that's one of the ways that whiteness works is by making itself invisible. And so one of the things that's helpful is to make it visible again. To say this is, you know, to say that this kind of crime happens a lot among white people. To say that this person I met is a white person. To say that this neighborhood is a white neighborhood. So that we see that we're actually talking about a reality that's racialized as well as the other realities that are racialized.
Okay, that's one. We got 10 minutes. Anyone else got any other?
I just want to throw out as a literature teacher that is a much bigger thing than you've, and I know you realize that. It's not a small thing. And how we throw around gender pronouns as well. But now you're talking about race, and it's a really important thing. There's a hand back there.
I think that's brilliant. And I think that giving words to understand and acknowledge the situations are really important. I'm afraid that the overseer position just lets everything happen. And we can't give words and the privileged into discussion, I think we'll be able to talk about it openly. And there's a quote that I'm trying to remember that's actually posted on the bathroom in the lodge one. I believe it's Elie Wiesel. It says something about, if anybody recognizes the quote, maybe you can correct me, but it has something to do with we may not be able to prevent injustice, but let us not ever let injustice happen or continue. I can't remember exactly what it is.
I think it's there may be times when we are powerless to prevent injustice, but there should never be a time when we are not angered by it, or something to that effect.
Yeah, well, maybe, at least for me, it seems to be semi-commonplace in the church if Thrivent comes in or somebody's to do a or a stewardship talk, to do a financial history for yourself, to go back and look at, and the goal always is to see that, you know, you receive stuff from your parents or you receive stuff from the church, you should be giving it back. That's sort of the goal, you know, look at your financial history. I think it would be really interesting for me personally to go back and do my financial history with the question in mind, why do I have this legacy or why do I have this privilege? And how much of that came from hard work with my parents or benefits from the GI Bill or something like that. So what I'm trying to say is there's a practice in place already in the church of doing financial stewardship histories. And it's interesting for me to try to track down, you know, where you come from.
I have a challenge for the Democrats in the room. What are you going to do to stop the Democratic Party from treating the African American communities like their personal plantation? Vote so they can always trust whether or not the Democratic Party gives anything back to those communities.
Start changing the way you vote.
Well, we're gonna, for me?
Yeah.
Oh, you don't believe I haven't voted weirdly.
Yeah. I'm sure, Peter, you voted.
But I was a John Anderson supporter in
matters,
76.
It matters that you're, you know, I study American history. There's a little tiny group in New York that lived on land that had really weird property rules when that was covered. And they had a tenure which made, every time they sold, anybody sold the land, they had to pay 25% of the sales price to the descendants of the original plantation, literally. And so they went on strike, and they wouldn't pay their taxes. And nobody paid any attention to them until they were the swing vote between the Whigs and the Democrats in the 1840 election. And then they ran in New York politics for four years. If black votes are safe for the Democratic Party, you don't have to do anything. If Southern votes are safe for the Democratic Party doesn't have to do anything for the South, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about the current kind of people who are leading the Democratic Party and falling in lockstep as overseers. I agree that it's my responsibility to vote intelligently and vote my interest. But for the past 40 years, the Democratic Party, which is made up in large part of Holden types,
right? Yeah.
Has abused this trust. And that's part of, and I think that's part of the Democratic Party's
white privilege. And in this next year and a half, we're going to see in the faith community a tremendous, the Democratic Party is being trained now in huge numbers in terms of how to be in conversation with faith communities effectively. They're really going to come. I think that to answer your question, I'm curious. I don't know if this is an effective or helpful, but I have got to experience the color of fear up here last year, and then I used that in a class I taught. Probably going to use it in my parish this year. Is that a tool that, my experience is it's been pretty helpful for people to think about things differently. It may not be as good as some of these other things.
Is that the video series?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's this Asian gentleman.
Yeah. I've seen, I know what you're talking about. It's just one video, right?
Yeah, it's not a series. I was talking to somebody from Concordia College today who says there's a new version that has women also.
Oh, okay.
But it's pretty powerful.
You know, my thing is that's wonderful, nice, personal stuff. I just don't care if a white person likes me. I don't care. You know, that does nothing for me. You know, I grew up, I shouldn't say I grew up, but people I met in school and college and whatever, who I consider my friends, you know, they're white people who grew up, and, you know, as we grew up, they made more money, they got better jobs, you know, they take better vacations, and here I am, you know, and we're friends, yeah, we still are friends, but a lot of my friendship with them depends on me, you know, swallowing my tongue and you know, congratulating them on their new house, on where they moved to, on their trip, on their raise, on their good job, you know, and that's hard work.
Sensitivity training doesn't necessarily lead to structural system.
No, you know, my thing is you need to disrupt things as they are. And if you're not doing that, to hell with you. You know, your job is to disrupt the status quo. If you cannot disrupt the status quo, then you are wasting my time. You are wasting every black person's time if you cannot disrupt the status quo and somehow make some kind of difference in this buildup of economic privilege that you have.
Just to remind us of the charge against the apostles who were in prison, I think in the book of Acts, since I'm out of field now, was that they turned the world upside down. That's why they were in prison.
Yeah. I live in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is more than 50% black. And, I'm a full professor. I got all kinds of privileges. I have a really nice house and all sort of that sort of thing. And I also said my kids in public school and an interesting experience being there. I'm not going to give you any lessons from that. But I think turning the system around, and like Peter's comment about social class, that I think when the United States spends a dollar on a five-year-old instead of a dollar on an 85-year-old, things will get better for lots of people. And we do not provide, you know, should we have health insurance? Should we have health insurance? Yeah. It's a travesty. Somebody walks down I see a woman walking down one of the main streets of my neighborhood, and I wonder, why are you out? It's not safe enough for you to be in my neighborhood. And I live in Washington, D.C. Right? Why isn't my neighborhood so safe? Why are my public schools not better? Why are we not taking care of, why are we not investing in our people? I'm an economist. So I read stuff about racial differences and gender differences in an econometric kind of way. And I have a statistical way. And I have friends who write about it. And there is a difference. I mean, it's a difference that you can't make go away. Right? Equally qualified black and white people make different incomes. Equally qualified men and women make different incomes. Things have gotten a lot better over time if you track people. But still, it turns out for black people that income and where you live explains a lot of difference, right? Because you can control for those things, and then when you factor it back in, if we don't leave people behind, if we bring everybody up, if we invest in poor white children and poor black children, that has an enormous impact. And we have trouble doing that as a society. And, you know, it's not just racial, we have trouble pulling the levers to make those decisions. As I said, yeah.
And that's my question back about, you know, to the parties, to participating in the process itself. You know, why are we not more disruptive? My wife's a Dane, and she is absolutely perplexed that we would let so many people live on the streets.
Correct.
that in Denmark, if you see somebody on the street, you know that he or she has made a choice to be there.
Right.
Because she, you know, she's has a master's degree from the University of Oslo. When she divorced, she had to go on the dole for a while, and they checked on her. She moved from one apartment, moved into an apartment with a friend of hers, and within a month had 11, it's 5.5 million people, you know, million people in Denmark. But you know, think about states instead of countries, maybe.
Right.
For the oversight, excuse me. And she got a letter asking if this was a union,
right,
which would change her benefits within a month. Mm-hmm. You know, and these are the kinds of freedoms that we will not easily give up, to move around and be secretive and so on, be invisible when we choose to be. But every kid who's capable gets to go to university.
That's right.
Yeah. We can do that. We got more money than they do.
As I said on Monday, when I was talking about economic development, in Finland the largest occupation is women taking care of other people's children. Which means if you're 17 and you have a kid, they give you a job taking care of your kid and somebody else's kid. One of the biggest determinants of how well you do in the labor market is how much experience you have. Which means that those Finnish women continue to have a job and have experience. Whereas if you're 17 and we make you get out of the labor market because your benefits are indexed to your wages negatively, then we're double penalizing you, right? We're taking away your labor market experience, and we're saying you got to go on what we categorize as relief rather than giving you a job. And we don't want to invest money in that kid. He's not going to show up in the system until he's 5 years old, right? He'll start getting school lunches when he gets to kindergarten. Maybe unless, you know, Darlene, whoever was here, that
Darlene,
Ron was talking about the other day.
And she's working. She's in the neighborhood.
Right.
So there are examples of countries that, economies that have decided to take everyone along have been much more successful than we have chosen to be.
Yes. There was a great article in The Economist, which I read, comparing social mobility across countries. So what you do is you take the income of the father or the parents and the income of the children and see how well they explain each other. Right? And if they explain each other real well, it means you don't have a lot of social mobility. And if they don't explain each other at all, it means people are moving all over the place. This is the most mobile developed country is Norway. Because they provide everybody with an education. They say, you're born here, you get the tools. You screw up, you screw up. There's not equal outcomes guaranteed. And the United States is becoming progressively less capable. Not just racially, but income-wise.
Oh.
We're not investing in our children the way we should be.
Oh, there's...
So I might try to speak to both of your questions. I'll start with Berlin's. That you were talking about doing a private personal history to see, you know, where your money is coming from and to what extent that might be linked to white privilege. And then the next step is when you're making choices about your financial future, you're making choices about your job future, to think about, you know, are these things that are open to me a result of white privilege? You know, is it, to what extent is this ability to open this particular financial account thing, I don't know, I'm sorry, I'm lost about that, but to what extent is that based on my white privilege? And, you know, is it my choice to enter that stable middle upper class at this point? Or is it my choice to walk with people who don't have that same, you know, and so asking those questions at each juncture of your life is one way, I think, to disrupt the status quo. And then maybe that applies to the Democratic Party as well, in the sense that I feel like we've been told again and again, I voted for Nader and I was roundly accused of electing George Bush because of that. But I think we've been told again and again that, you know, that this party is the one that, you know, it's not the greatest, but it's our only option, you know. And in order to keep this only option alive, we have to have a white man who's wealthy, you know, who looks like the other presidential candidate.
From the
looks
South.
From the South, yeah, and who's got a chance of being elected, you know what I mean? And that's that same thing, that same thing, I think, as, you know, you need to have an IRA at this point in your life, you need to have your mortgage paid off at this point in your life. You know, it's that thing that this is the viable way to live, this is the viable way to have a president. And if we're able to stop at those situations and not let the machine keep rolling and just say, no, that's a start, too.
When I go home to visit my family, and these are all black, all working poor and less, and almost to a person, when they talk about the terrorists, you know, they say, good, blow them up, you know, because there's a certain sense of hopelessness there, that this was the only thing that white people will pay attention to, you know, anonymous people blowing themselves up.
So they're not talking about blowing up the terrorists.
Yeah.
They're not talking about our action against the terrorists.
Yeah. Yeah, they're talking about the terrorist action against us, you know. And to a person, they say, good, blow them up. I wished I could do it, you know. And by your not disrupting the system, by your inability to act on this kind of stuff, on these privileges, you send a message. And that message is simply that you simply do not count to us. You know, everything those people I grew up with, the black people that I grew up with, watch on TV just affirms all of that. You know, it just affirms that this country is about and for white people. And that, you know, it's just, nothing's going to change. They don't see anything on the horizon that's going to change. So,
there's another
hand. Well, Peter, you may have asked this rhetorically. There's so many, especially in Scandinavian countries, that all of that, they do all of that for everybody. They, you know, provide education and everything. And why can't we do that? And, you know, it tends to be people of an older generation than me that I've had this conversation with when I say, you know, that there's a lot of countries that I would choose to live in other than America, and they say, how could you ever possibly think that? And I point out particular Scandinavian countries, and they say, but their taxes are so high. Because they believe, because if our taxes are high to support that, it would hurt them financially because they don't see any of that, those numbers on the board. They think that's all money that is their due.
And I put these figures on the board for my students when we go through this. This is out of a PBS documentary. They say the same thing, and I ask them, well, how much does it cost your parents right now while you're going to university?
Right.
And we get up to about, you know, depending on the income, we get up to about 80% of the family's income is in insurance and taxes and sales taxes and college fees. You know, you're never going to get anywhere near that in any Scandinavian country or Germany, any social democratic party.
There's a great book called Growing Public by Peter Linder, L-I-N-D-E-R-T. There's a bunch of people from Davis who came in last night. He teaches at the University of California at Davis. That lays out these international comparisons about what happens. And I fight this all the time. I'm on a mission to say, if you look around the world, you see the 25 developed countries. The average size of government is over 40%. It's more like 44% of GDP. You go to the other 175 countries that are not developed, and the average size of government is a percentage of GDP. And remember, their GDPs are really small. It's 20%. That countries that are successful, not just economically developed, politically and socially developed, are largely countries that make enormous investments in their people. And so they have high taxes. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things is those, I don't want to jump to tomorrow morning, if you live in a society in which you don't trust your government, you don't get those services publicly provided. Mm-hmm. And we're one of those developed countries that really is paranoid about trust in our government, mm-hmm. right? I mean, in some sense, that's the heart of the Republican appeal.
They don't trust their government, but 43% of the tax benefits went to the top 1%.
Right.
You know, and but, you know, if that doesn't piss you off, what what does it take? You know, if that doesn't firmly give you an idea that you're just an overseer, you know, and that's money that's going to go on to your children, you know, that's a debt that your children are going to carry, you know, and
it doesn't make me feel like an overseer though, because I'm not in that top 1%.
Yeah, but overseers aren't. Overseers aren't. Overseers are people who whip the rest of the, who whip the slaves into submission. They're not at the top.
Let's, it's 9:55 and we've always agreed at Holden, for this reason, not to cut off your conversation, but to encourage it outside of these walls. I have one response. Barack Obama has a wonderful speech, it's in the library, about Christian language in the next election. And what the left can say that might be different from what the right says.
You can get it on the website.
And it's on the website. We got two of them right here in the library. And then we had one last, the last one was, Harry hasn't spoken yet, so we'll, you have your hand up, Lee.
Oh, not to pressure. this goes way back to what Peter mentioned about Benjamin. A few months ago, I heard a speaker from the Niger Delta talking about the oil companies and the oppression of the indigenous peoples there. And about how they've been demonstrating nonviolently for 30 years, but he says, how many of you are aware of it? Nobody's aware of it. And there are those that are saying they need to do other things, but he mentions that a pipeline has blown up, and immediately it's on the news in the United States, and they have everybody's attention because blowing up an oil pipeline has an impact on the economy.
On $3.25 a gallon, yeah.
But you can do that as individuals, too. I mean, you can opt out of economically participating, at least some oppressive
groups. Thank you, everyone. Carry on.